Hi, everybody. Laura DeLind is here to talk with us today. Laura is a faculty member in the MSU Department of Anthropology. She also works with the civic engagement portion of the curriculum in the Residential College of Art in Arts and Humanities. She has, as an academic activist, she has tried to reconnect food and farming to ecological health, democracy, and community development. Her interest in agriculture and the food system began in the 80s when she began to wonder why family-scale farmers were suffering economically. And that led her to consider the larger agri-food system. She's written a number of academic papers arguing that the existing food system is inequitable and unsustainable, and began to consider alternative ways to support farmers and the eating public. One of the models that caught her attention was community-supported agriculture, and she's been involved in that in our communities locally for a number of years. But she's here to talk to us today about the Urbandale Farm. Laura is also an artist, an early member of the East Lansing Food Co-op, and a friend of mine. Laura?
That was great. Ooh, I'm echoing. Hi. Are you sure you don't want to come up and be friendly? Oh, come on. Yeah, I would. I would. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. I have been involved in critically looking at the food system, our contemporary food system, for a while. But over and the things that Chris mentioned are things that I have done most recently, probably the last 8 to 10 years, after my CSA lost the land and we disbanded, was to work in an urban setting, working with the Allen Neighborhood Center on Lansing's East Side. And we worked with a number of issues, but they ultimately were designed to create something we call an urban food system, piece by piece. We started with trying to bring urban fringe farmers into a relationship with urban eaters and create new markets for small farmers. And that's what gave rise to the Allen Street Farmers Market. Then we started working with educational issues in agriculture, which ultimately gave rise to the garden house in Hunter Park. And then coursework classes there in an urban certificate program to involve urban residents in an understanding of their own food production and in natural processes as well, that the two, the rural, the urban, nature, and city, needed not be divorced from one another and shouldn't be divorced from one another. And as we kept working, we realized that there were more and more pieces that needed to be put together if we were really going to create something that was more sustainable and sustaining. And one of those pieces was a production unit, a unit where we could really start producing food. The garden house was lovely and it was a very good demonstration project, but you couldn't produce much in the way of food for a city or even a quadrant of a city. And so we started thinking, how might we do that? And a friend of mine who had also gone through MSU's organic farmer training program through the Student Organic Farm, and had been a member of my CSA years back, and I decided that what we really ought to do is try and think about creating an urban farm on the east side. And we talked this over with the folks at Allen Neighborhood Center, and it fit with what they were doing. We were friends. We'd been working together for a long while. And that sort of gave birth to a nonprofit that Linda Anderson and I, this is sort of my co-founder, created, called the Lansing Urban Farm Project. And it's very, very new. The first year of operation was last year. And we had the first project was the Urbandale Farm, and that's what I'd like to talk to you a little bit about, what we're doing there and what we hope to do there in the future. Oops, pressed the wrong button. I always do that. I think this will work. There we go. The mission of the nonprofit, and it's a Michigan nonprofit, it is not a 501c3 at this point, and that's another connection we have with Allen, the Allen Neighborhood Center, because they serve as our fiduciary. And so grants that we write, donations that we may receive, et cetera, go through Allen and then get earmarked for us. They sort of are our guardian angel. But the purpose is it was to make food, fresh food, available to urban residents. And in addition to use, and this is the part that particularly fascinates me as a social scientist, to use this kind of agriculture, this earthwork, as a vehicle for building back, in many cases, in neighborhoods, a sense of place, and through a sense of place and collect sense of collective of work and ownership of land and commons and activity to build a sense of empowerment, a civic sense of responsibility among urban residents. And we wanted to, whatever we did, we wanted to do it in a way that fit the place, that fit the population, and that could ultimately be taken over by people who live there so it becomes theirs, and we could leave, and that it could sustain itself over time. When we began, we found a half acre in Urbandale that did not have any houses on it. I'd like to figure out what the history of that particular plot was, because in an urban space, that's pretty remarkable. Didn't have trees in the center of it. It was pretty open. It was overrun by brambles and things, but it had a lot of sunshine available, and it was owned by the land bank. And the land bank said, "Yep, it's yours. Use it for this purpose." And given how I lost the land for growing in place, the CSA, to have somebody just offer me land was just so astonishing that I smiled that entire day. It was wonderful. This is the land. This is the property in mid-April of last year. And by early August, this is what it looked like after we started working with it. This is that same piece of property, again, in mid-April, looking east. And in August, also looking east. This is that same property before we began, looking south and southwest. And there it is again. So you can see the change we made in it. And it also, of course, changed us along the way. It was a fabulous experience. What we and the work that we did was Linda, myself, Sarah, who started as a AmeriCorps volunteer, and after we've gotten a fairly sizable grant, which I'll speak about later, we've been able to employ her as a farm manager. A lot of volunteer labor from MSU, from Eastside neighbors, and Urbandale residents also went into creating this. So where's Urbandale? As you, I have this toy. I have to hold it down. This is 127, this is 496, this is Kalamazoo, and this is Aurelius or Clemens. So, excuse me? This is Kalamazoo. 496. Did I misstate? Okay. As you see, it's sort of in a cul-de-sac. This is, of course, where the farm is, and on that open half acre.
That's Lansing Township.
Part of it, yes. Part of it's Lansing Township, and part of it is the city. And that's another issue that neighborhood has to deal with because of those two jurisdictions, yeah. Why Urbandale? Well, we could say in literally it is a dead end, but also figuratively it has challenges. It is an area that's economically depressed. It is an area that has had a good deal of foreclosed houses. It also is, and I'll work with this, it's an area that is called a food desert. It's difficult for many residents to get to a full service grocery, especially if they have no means of transportation. And 20% of the population in Urbandale does not have access to a car. So that's difficult. Those places that are easily available look a bit like this. This is an empty party store that's just down the street. This is one that's very close, within walking distance, and of course it features, you know, the three main food groups, beer, wine, and cell phones. So that there are some difficulties here. This is across the street from the Allen Neighborhood Center. It has more in the way of produce, but it doesn't have a whole lot. And this is basically what urban residents have at their disposal, especially if they don't have easy access to transportation. So it's a food desert. It also is an area in which there are a lot of empty houses, a lot of foreclosed houses, a lot of abandoned properties. This being one example, the farm is on South Hayford, and I walked up and down, and 25% of the homes that still exist there are either empty, abandoned, or somehow neglected, seriously neglected. There are a lot of red-tagged houses. This was a red-tagged house was right across from the farm, happened this winter, and so it's yet another property that needs attention. Also, it's an area that's in the floodplain. It's in Lansing's 100-year floodplain, and you can see how this overlaps, how pretty completely it overlaps the neighborhood, the Urbandale neighborhood. In the last flood was 1975, and that was what was called a 25-year flood, and this is what the neighborhood looked like at the time. There was a great deal of damage, a great deal of lost property. It is not a rich area. Most people don't have flood insurance, so there was a lot of loss of property, loss of homes, and many of these homes now are being targeted in a way by the city because they have FEMA funds, and FEMA would like to remove residents from that area so that they don't have to deal with flooding as an issue for this population. But it's also an area with a lot going for it. It has a good deal. It has a personality. It has a deep history. It's from what I'm understanding, it was the first blue-collar subdivision in Lansing. A lot of GM workers lived there. It is a population with a considerable diversity of residents. There are African-American residents. There are Hispanic-American residents. There are Asian-American residents. There are people who are service workers. There are people who live on welfare. There are students. There's a range of background and of interest, and there are also tons of kids. It's one of those streets and areas where they tumble out when the weather's good. They're on the streets, and because the streets aren't through ways, because of the dead end, they can play in the streets fairly safely and have relay races. So it has a lot of amenity. They're beautiful trees, mature trees, and that makes the space look very rural. And of course, the open space is green, and it has a look of a rural ambience, which is and some of the streets aren't even paved, which give it a character that the contrast with many urban, typical urban settings. Many people just like being there. Some can't move because even with the offer FEMA's making, they can't sell their house for enough to buy another one elsewhere. And some really just want to stay. They've lived there for generations and they like it, and this is where they'd like to be. So this is just an illustration. This was a warm October day, and again, people were kind of tumbling out, playing, doing whatever needed to be done in the yard, on the street. This is the farm yet again, and we have farm markets on site 2 days a week. We also have a market at the Allen Street Farmers Market on Wednesdays. So there's three markets throughout the growing season. And they've been quite successful. We arranged to have a three-tiered price structure. And the reason for that is the first tier is the price that anybody coming up and purchasing a zucchini or a tomato any place would pay. We did not want to in any way undercut smaller farmers, smaller producers who might sell, say, at Allen, and for whom this was their livelihood. This was not anything we wanted to do. We weren't trying to fix one problem and create another. The second tier is for Urbandale residents. If you live in Urbandale, you get a 35% discounted price just automatically. Also, if you've volunteered with us, you get a discount. The third tier is if you are an Urbandale resident and you have worked with us, then you get 50% off. It's a way not only of making food more available to this population, but also encouraging them to engage and take on a sense of ownership and of the project. And eventually we hope that enough people will do this that we can leave and start some mischief somewhere else. We started in really harvesting around July, which is not what we're going to do this year. We'll begin much earlier. And we made upwards of $2,500 in produce sales. 20% of that was made to Urbandale residents. About 20% of all the volunteers were Urbandale residents. And even more encouraging than that, about 85% of all the Urbandale residents who did volunteer volunteered more than once. So that there was a certain commitment and a feeling that, you know, this was something that they enjoyed. Those are some of the stats, but as a social scientist, I'm not as interested in the stats as I am in what this activity, what this earthwork really does for the place, what it does for the neighbors, what it does for building back a sense of neighborhood and community. And one of the first things we found, were that kids gravitated to the place. They were the forward scouts. We didn't see nearly as many adults as we saw kids. They rode by on their bikes, they walked by, they yelled, they played, they came in, they explored. And our farm manager is brilliant with kids, and she invited them in, and she showed them things, and she asked them if they wanted to help, and of course they did. Some were actually a help, and some weren't, but they were all coming. They all came in, and this was something we began was called a sunflower spiral, and we had them help us create it. This is what it looked like, and after it grew up, it became a maze, which was the whole idea, and kids wandered through it until they got to the center, and then wandered out again. And in the foreground are our pumpkins, which the kids also helped plant, which is part of another story we'll get to. And it's these stories that, and the process of new relationship making that really intrigue me, that are enabled through this kind of activity. They, as I was saying, here we are in the middle of a city, and kids are being introduced to insects and animals and all kinds of critters. And this is a tobacco hornworm, and it's on our tomato plant, and we spent a lot of time pulling them off getting rid of them, and kids really loved finding them and getting rid of them. But they weren't grossed out. They were fascinated by them. Equally fascinated when they found that nature has ways of also getting rid of them. And this is a parasitic wasp that lays eggs on the hornworm, and the eggs then, when they hatch, begin to devour the worm. And so it was another way of learning about natural processes and ant lions and all sorts of new experiences. It was reattaching urban dwellers who are no less fascinated by green and growing processes than anybody else. We have many stories, and this is one of them. This is Nancy, and Nancy lived next door to the farm, and we used to say that we made Nancy's summer, but in truth, Nancy made ours. Nancy was there every day. She planted with us, she picked off worms, she knew exactly how many tomatoes were turning red and would tell you every day when you went to work. She knew exactly how many sunflowers were opening, and she would tell you and show you. She just was always there. And so we put her to work at the farm stand, and she said, no, she couldn't do that. She wasn't a math gal. And we said, which really was what she meant, was she didn't know how to make change. And so we said, well, that's just too bad. If you're going to work with us, you're going to make change. And over the course of the summer, Nancy learned to make change. And it was really a fascinating process. And we would play with her, and we would instruct, make games. You know, okay, Nancy, if I bought $3.50 worth of tomatoes and I gave you $5, what would my change be? And she'd wrestle with it and work it out. She got it. She ultimately got it. Now, who is she with? She is with Julie the chicken. Julie got dumped in the farm by somebody unknown. I guess they felt that this was a good place for a chicken when they didn't want it. And Nancy saw the chicken, and she ran it out. She saved it, and she took it home with her. And they have been inseparable ever since. Julie lives with Nancy. And Nancy's family, much to her father's chagrin, but nonetheless, he's allowed that. And now, I know I was back there 2 days ago, Julie is laying eggs. And so beginning to pay for, but here's another, a pet and a nurturing opportunity for Nancy that she hadn't had before. This is Rudy. This actually is Nancy's father, and he just came over, and he's a very handy fellow, and we would not ask things of him, and he would say, that fence gate doesn't open very well, and he said, I think I'll fix it, and he fixed it. Or he'll say, this is buckwheat that we were using as a green manure, and he just said, okay, it's ready to harvest, I'll knock it down for you. And there were all kinds of things that he did for us that I found really very fascinating, that he just took it on because he felt this was a project that meant something to him. This is a great story. This is another fellow who lives across the street. He's moved since. And he was a bit of a recluse. He hardly ever came out until one day we were taking out the brush in the fence line. And he said, you gonna take all that brush out? And we said, yeah. He says, what about these trees here? They're scrub, you know. And we said, well, and he said, I can help you. So I said, oh, okay. Every time we were there, he came with his tools around his neck, just like that, and spent the afternoon or the evening knocking down scrub trees, clearing the brush, cutting things up for us. And turns out he was working on a degree in horticulture, and he knew all these species. He knew, and he would bring things over and plant them for us. And one day I happened to be sitting right there, standing actually, and Nancy was there behind the stand, and Andy came over and said to Nancy, who are you? Now, mind you, he had been living for 6 years across from the farm, and Nancy had been living for 6 years beside the farm. He said, who are you? And he said, what's your name?
She said, "My name's Nancy." And she said, "What's your name?" And he says, "Andy." And she said, and then Andy says, "Who's that man over there?" And Nancy said, "That's my dad. That's Rudy." And he said, "Oh, okay." I'm standing right there. These people had never interacted. And the next day, next week, Andy comes over and Nancy says, "Hi, Andy." And he says, "Hi, Nancy." And they start teasing each other and interacting and playing. And then we had some parties later on and they all came. It just began to be a place, a commons, a public space in which people began to feel comfortable enough to begin talking and interacting with each other. These two women live down the block. They are on a limited income. They also have health issues. And they spent some time working with us at the farm and purchasing produce with us and keeping an eye out on the farm just to make sure nobody jumped the fence or took things that they shouldn't have. And they came, and one day at the end of the day, one of them said, "Come on over, I want to talk with you." And I said, "Okay." And they said, "We have a plan, we have an idea we want to pass by you." And I said, "All right." And I was getting a little nervous. But they said, "You know, we love this farm." And I said, "Oh," and being a glutton for compliments, I said, "Why?" And they said, "Well, because it's made this community much more lively. We have things to do on Tuesdays and Saturdays." That's when we had the market. People come by now and wave, and it's a friendlier place. And they said, "What we'd like to do, we thought about it, and we'd like to give the farm $35. Which was, for them, not inconsiderable. And they said, "But what really we want to do with it is we want to have a Halloween party. We want to have a Halloween party for the neighborhood." And what they had in mind probably would have cost $350, not $35, but we said, "Okay, let's work on it." And we did. And we had a Halloween party. And we took the pumpkins, and they baked cupcakes, and they bought cider. And we had a party. And it was a lot of fun, and there were two just in character. And at the end of that party, one of the women said, "You know, I think this will be a tradition." And it's just yet another way in which people have sort of taken ownership of what we're doing and it making it theirs and sharing it with others in ways that they haven't had an opportunity to do for a while. This is the house just north of the farm, immediately north. It's also land bank property, and it was offered to us if we brought it back up to code. Slow by slow, all winter, we've been scrubbing and putting in windows and drywall and doing what we can with it. It still needs work, but it's on its way. And hopefully what we're going to do is this is where we're going to have the farm manager live 24/7, so be part of the community. And if we get a greenhouse or a hoop house, can manage that too on a pretty intensive basis. This is a lot. A bit north on the same street. We call it the five lot lot. It's five lots that are empty now, once had houses. There are many stories there that we're going to have to collect. Who lived there? What had they done there? What are their memories? I don't know. But we really ought to not forget that these were inhabited spaces and before we turned them into something else. And they're pretty open. They had trees, and Eric Schertzing, with his chainsaw, chopped down a good many of them. And there the stumps lie. And kids play on it. And I noticed that when I'd come down, we were going to open it up and make another set of garden plots for the farm. But kids were playing on them. And I said, "You know, this isn't right. This is their front yards, these are the backyards. We ought to involve them in this process." So a young man who lives right next door, happens to be a graduate student in CARS, is going to work with neighborhood kids
to think, invite them to, how do we design this space? How are we going to do this five-lot lot in a way so that we can grow, but they can also play? How do we do it so that we can do, can we use those logs? Can we use the brambles? Can we build something? Would they like to work with us? But so that it becomes part of their decision-making and their design effort as well. And then I'm working with a couple of students in landscape architecture to take the kids' visions and do some mapping with us so that we have a plan for this spring. Another project that we're working on is called the Veggie Wagon. And the Veggie Wagon is this Vermont cart that we're going to have middle school kids take around the neighborhood with produce in coolers. And so it could just go around the neighborhood, or it could be funky. And we really thought it should have an identity. It should be a lot of fun, and people should have helped us work with this and design it. So we have a Veggie Wagon challenge out. And we flyered all the houses in Urbandale with this Veggie Wagon challenge, and we're asking that little teams come together of 3 to 5 people. They have to have one adult, at least one child, and at least 2 households. And to work together and figure out what designs are going to be on those Veggie Wagons, what kind of shading mechanism are we going to use, what kind of jingles and bells and whistles are they going to have so they can compete with the ice cream man. I mean, we all know what the Good Humor ice cream man, well, what does a Veggie Wagon sound like? And we have little prizes. We have some money to give out as prizes for the 3 designs that we think are most creative. So that's in the works. We've received a USDA grant, a pretty sizable grant, which has allowed us to hire a farm manager and to begin this year an apprenticeship program. So we are going to take on 3 young adults, hopefully from the Urbandale area, adults who are not college-bound and who are presently unemployed, who want to learn horticultural skills and who want to start growing food for people in their own communities. And it's going to be a 6-month curriculum. They have a $4,000 stipend, and they will work with us. And at the end, the land bank will offer them a piece of land bank property on which to grow if that's what they want to do. And so that's up for, and these are our partners. None of what we've done have we done by ourselves. We certainly work closely with the land bank. We've gotten a community development block grant from the Lansing Office of Planning and Neighborhood Development. The Allen Neighborhood Center has extended all kinds of services to us. The Student Organic Farm has given us advice and assistance. The food bank, the Greater Lansing Food Bank, their garden project has offered us liability insurance. The students in the residential college, the arts and humanities, have come and done engagement work there. And of course, Urbandale residents themselves have been highly invested in this project, and we're hoping over the course of the next couple years, they will be more so. Because we think our idea is that over the next 3-5 years, we'll probably keep adding in properties until we get to be about 5 acres in total. And that's that. This is our website, but I have brochures over there and a card if you have any interest, and it has that information on it as well. And that is the presentation, and I'd be happy to talk with you about any or all of that. Sure.
First question, where did you get water from? Were you able to use some of these hoses?
Very good question. That was another partnership. Initially, we did it, we had a partnership with the Garden Project, and we had a RPZ, I think they're called. They're devices from the Board of Water and Light that open up hydrants. And we would have hoses, we'd open up hydrants, we'd fill rain barrels, and we had rain barrels, and we would water by hand, just as we did everything. This is a pretty labor-intensive process. And we worked that for a while. Then when we got the house, which is right next door to this half-acre site, we were able to run hose and do some watering in that way.
And the second question is, the land that you got that you knew that had houses on it at one time, did you fear for debris in the soil, like broken glass, and things that could hurt you, the gardeners, or children if they were to fall?
Okay. For our first site, we had it tested, and we have all the soil tested. We have it tested for nutrients, for its growing properties, as well as heavy metals, and anything that's harmful. And they've been clean. Both sites are clean. Is there debris? I am sure there is. And we spent time cleaning and collecting both surface debris and other materials that were left. There hasn't been all that much. There will be. The way in which houses are demolished, though, they do collapse them into basements, and then put the soil over the top, which is not my preferred way of doing it. I'd rather have them, it all taken away. But we haven't had any problems at this point. But it is something to consider. Yes. And I'm hoping too that as people begin to invest themselves in these properties and in these activities, they'll have a different sense of responsibility and relationship to them. We there's this wonderful little story that Matthew, who's the graduate student, saw. One little fella from across the street came one day. This was before we began working with a five-lot lot at all, and he had a computer monitor. And he's 10 years old and full of curiosity, and he had the computer monitor, and Matthew watched him and couldn't quite believe it, and he took it and he dropped it right there on the sidewalk to see what would happen. And of course, it went pew. And at the moment, it was sort of had left his hands, and before it hit the sidewalk, Matthew said, "No!" And his mother, who was across the street, said, "What are you doing?" And if we invite him in, I have a funny feeling there won't be as many computer monitors dropped. There'll be a different set of interactions with those spaces. That's my theory. Who knows? Maybe I'm wrong. But that's the process I'd like to watch, and those are the relationships I'd like to see form and sort of document if they do. Yeah?
Yeah, kind of building on that, how did you, so you've got a fence around your farm.
That came with the property. We did not put that up.
I'm wondering, how did you decide? I mean, I know you wanted to invite anybody in the neighborhood to join you. How did you decide who was interested enough to get access versus other people may just wander through or may want to vandalize the place, or how did you work out those?
And you bring up a very important point, and one that we are wrestling with. The fact that the property that we first began with had a fence made it easier for us to control the initial process. When we were there, the gates were open and anybody could come, and we were there almost every single day of the week, and certainly during the times when we had on-farm markets, people were invited. We had signs out on Kalamazoo and all we put signs in the soil at corners and things, and people would come. And so everyone was welcome, and we'd explain what we were doing, and if they wanted to help us harvest or pick hornworms or whatever, that's what we did. We had little liability waivers and so forth. But we did argue about, if this belongs to, this is not ours, if this belongs to the community, why do we lock it up? And we said initially we did because we had absolutely no place to keep our tools. We now have a shed that's we haven't assembled, one that comes in 680 pieces and then you put it together. Well, it's in 680 pieces right now, and we plan on putting it together, and we'll have a place to hold tools. But we had no place to hold tools, and we didn't have the house yet either. And so we felt that perhaps we wanted a little bit more control over the beginning. we're thinking that we probably will leave the gate open, and we won't have a fence at all on the five-lot lot. So I think the greatest protection, the greatest liability insurance is for everybody to be invested in it. Will there be problems? I'm sure there will be. But I think, I'm hoping there'll be fewer than we anticipate. You know, that, yeah. And then if kids say, I planted that and I'm watching it, they'll be a little less likely to have to pull it up themselves or to have allow someone else to do it. We'll see. There's also a project that we were talking about. Eric Schertzing, who has a million ideas. I mean, he's magnificent. And he was out there hauling and hoeing and moving earth with us every work day we had. He his idea was to, let's use one of the lots as a to plant trees and do Christmas trees. And I said, well, if you do that, then the kids have to plant them. And they become their trees. And then they can watch them grow. And when they get to be a suitable size, they can cut them and take them home. And, it, you know, the trees, and we can redo it. And so I think if we allow younger people, especially, to feel proud of the work that they're doing and to have some ownership in it, that it may cut down on some of the less socially responsible stuff. You know.
Well, I'm also thinking, though, I mean, so you're growing these, people are planting them, but you're selling them, too.
We are.
Giving them away for...
No, we're not.
And I know, like, I garden with some people in downtown Lansing, and for some people, there's sort of a culture that if you see something growing, you can just pick it, that it's just, like, leaves off a tree, that it just...
Mm-hmm.
You see it, it belongs to anybody. So they will just come to
They may, or there may be a sign that explains it. And we've also had this one year of establishing a pattern, a sort of a routine that people, not everybody, but many people now recognize with us that we're on Tuesday evenings and on Saturday mornings, we have a farm market there with a veggie wagon going around. That may also alert people to it. But maybe there'll be some things that are for picking. We'll maybe on a spare lot we'll plant berry bushes, and it'll be just an edible landscape. And if you get it there before the birds, they're here. You know, we can still. I think there are many different models that we can play with. But we'll have to pay attention. It's not going to be simple. And there'll need to be a lot of communication, and I do think buy-in from many different people along the way. Yeah.
So you start with a half-acre lot. I live on the west side of the west side neighborhood. We also have a food desert on that side of town. What size do you think, based on your experience now, is required to actually start something like this? I mean, we have various lots from the land bank that we're using as garden project spaces where people can sign up to have their own plot of land, but nothing that's a whole lot devoted to something like this. And I think this is a great idea, so I'm curious to hear more about, you know, in retrospect, did you need a half acre? Did you start using the whole half acre? Or were you really looking at one or two lots that you started with? I see if you have a lot.
I think we would have begun with just a lot.
One?
Well, one, and begun and with the idea of expanding. This was a very fortunate find for us, and especially since it was in a floodplain, cannot be developed, and it was owned by the land bank, and it I think it had a pump house on it, and it hadn't had a residence. So we lucked out in this case. It's a good size, and it's certainly, I don't think we could have managed, because really, the most intensive work was done by three people. I don't think we could have gone much farther the first season. There's an awful lot you can grow intensively. So on a quarter acre, I'm sure, you know, or half of that, you could have made a good showing of food production. And I think it's also aesthetic. There's a lot of, I think, to do it in a way that is sort of inspirational. There's something wonderful about seeing a place that was littered with trash and that nobody used become a place that people want to come and like want to hang out and just learn each other's names and kind of talk about stuff. I would love to see things happen there that have nothing to do with food. You know, somebody says, where do you live? I live over there. Oh, you live by that house? Yeah, well, that's a mess. Yeah, I wonder why we aren't cleaning up. Well, I was wondering that too. Well, let's go and do something about it. Or let's ask somebody at the township. Or I really would like a bus route right here. And there isn't any. Yeah, I've been thinking that. So that they work together to improve the quality of the neighborhood and their collective experience there. But I don't know that there's any, you know, hard and fast rule. Depends on how many people, how much knowledge they have for growing, about growing. It's work. It's a lot of work, but if it's sweaty and it's tiring, and I think it's an amazing amount of fun. I really do enjoy it. And I get this high when other people come and we start doing it together. It really, really makes me feel warm and fuzzy. You know, it does. Yeah.
Do you have like any kind of organizational meetings? And if so, do you meet at the Allen Center or
Except
for planning things?
Yeah. Yeah. We have lots. All winter, ever since we stopped, we have a very long list of volunteers, which we call them work parties. You know, we have to put the garden to bed, or we want to work on the house and pull out carpet or whatever. We have people come. But probably the end of October was the last time anybody worked in on the farm itself. Since at that time, Linda and myself and Sarah, the farm manager, have been meet once a week for somewhere anywhere between 2 and 4 hours to develop the curriculum for the apprentices, to think about how we're going to grow this next season, what we would like to do in the best of all worlds with that 5-lot lot, how to promote and the veggie wagon challenge, how to promote for and advertise for apprentices. All the behind the scenes planning work, writing grants, and yes, we meet at Allen. They've given us a desk and a space, and every grant we write has a percentage, administrative percentage for Allen to return to them, you know, the some compensation for the space we take up and the Xerox machine that we use and so forth. So, yeah, and it's very nice. We're very separate entities, but we work together closely, and we each know what the other's doing. Anybody want to help me do this? Anyone want to join in? We are going to start working again probably mid-April, depending, of course, on what's going on outside. If it's snowing, we'll probably wait a little bit. We've started starts already. We've started flats of seed. We've ordered our seeds and started flats, and we keep them at the Hunter Park Garden House, is where they are. So we're integrating our work with other programs and resources on the east side, so that it sort of becomes a piece, so that we're not separate, that we each improve and work with the other.
So how long the grant last?
This grant will be 2 years. And, hopefully we really can't rely on grants, and nor should we rely on them. And so what we're wanting to do is to use them to get a jump start and then begin to produce enough so that we can pay a farm manager and we can buy seed. There's never going to be any profit taking in this. But just that we can manage One other asset that we were, was the house, because in exchange for bringing it up to code, we can rent it. And while we rent it at a very subsidized rate to a farm manager in exchange for the work, that generates a little income as well. So that'll go right back into the farm. And we've been finding some interesting things too, that people, the tool shed that we have, we were thinking, could we buy a tool shed? They cost a lot of money. We didn't have the money. What were we going to do? Were we going to build one? Were we going to use the basement of the house? And then just out of nowhere, a neighbor came and said, I bought myself a tool shed, but I never put it together, and I'm not going to. Would you be interested in it? You know, and so we find these, you can't plan on that kind of stuff. But it happens more times than not, oddly enough. So if you, if I have a piece of paper, if you want to, if anybody is interested in being on the mailing list and keeping track of us, or coming in and to a work party, you'd be more than welcome.
Okay. Thanks very much, Laura.
Okay, you're welcome.